Chapter 1. Dr. Jennifer Stone came storming into Senator Bryce Carman's office on the 7th floor of the federal building. She brushed past Carman's startled secretary, threw open the door, and stalked up to his desk in a fury.
"All right, Bryce,"
she said, leaning over his desk, her green eyes flashing.
"What the hell is going on?"
Carman looked up at her. Ordinarily, Jennifer Stone was a woman of stunning beauty. Angry? She was breathtaking. Her shoulder-length red hair was in an attractive disarray, some heavy strands falling over one eye. Her patrician features were flushed, and her mouth slightly open as she breathed heavily from rushing down to Carmen's office from her own office on the 22nd floor, gave her an appearance that would have excited considerable passion in most men. Carman had other passions, however, and women were not one of them. The White Knight, as he was called by his colleagues in the media, was not a man given to most of the baser human vices. He did not smoke or drink. He used no stimulants or depressants. And though many women, and some men, had tried to avail themselves of the august senatorial corpus, none had succeeded. His interest in women was limited solely to an artist's appreciation of their physical beauty, nor did good-looking young men interest him beyond their potential usefulness in his complex machinations. What inflamed Carman's passion was power. He had accumulated quite a lot of it and was ruthless in the manner in which he employed it. Carman was a very wealthy man. In his mid-60s, he was robust-looking, husky, elegantly dressed, with startling blue eyes and skin so pale it was almost translucent. He had a thick shock of snow-white hair and a voice like a revival preacher, which he could have easily been. In fact, he often borrowed their oratorical pyrotechnics when he spoke in Congress or in the public. He was not religious, but he frequently invoked the name of God and publicly stood righteous and foursquare for morality. His manner was avuncular and his appearance distinguished. He looked like the sort of man you'd trust with your life savings, but looks were deceptive. Carman was that most frightening of nature's creatures, the well-adjusted sociopath. And he knew exactly what he was. When he was born, he had been born with something vital missing, a conscience. He had no sense whatsoever of right and wrong. He had no compassion. Certain basic, essential human feelings were completely lacking in him. Like the true sociopath he was incapable of feeling anyone's pain but his own. He possessed no consideration for the rights and needs of others, and love was a concept he couldn't even begin to understand. Men like Carman frequently became diabolically clever serial killers. Something had gone wrong in the brain chemistry. Incapable of true feelings of their own, sociopaths most frequently found satisfaction in manipulating the feelings of others, watching those over whom they ruthlessly exercised control with the same detached fascination a child might have when torturing a bug. They became masters of the art. Machiavellian in their machinations, the quintessential con men, appallingly adroit liars, utterly merciless sadists. Few were capable of effective self-control for any length of time. Most sociopaths were time bombs, going through life mimicking normal human behavior like chameleons, learning social interaction like an actor learns a part, playing at being human. But inside, they were monsters, shark-like predators that could explode into terrifying violence at any moment. But Bryce Carman was the rare exception. Intelligent and perceptive, Carman had a complete understanding of his condition and had accepted it decades earlier, while still a very young man. More than accepted it, Carman embraced it. He regarded himself as a superior human being, incapable of the sort of feelings that made others weak. He did not repress his perverse, manipulative desires. Instead, he had found a way to channel them constructively and effectively. He had gone into politics, a profession designed for his peculiar talents, an arena in which a conscienceless manipulator could go far.
"I'm sorry, sir," his secretary said, coming in behind Jennifer. "She just came bursting in past me before I could..."
"That's quite all right," said Carman calmly. "I'll take care of it." He waited till his secretary left. "Now, what seems to be the problem, Jennifer?" he asked calmly, as if this sort of abrupt intrusion was a perfectly normal occurrence. He raised his bushy eyebrows slightly.
"You know damn well what the problem is,"
she snapped.
"Do I? Well, perhaps you'd better tell me anyway. I've had a rather lot on my mind, and I'm a bit slow on the uptake today."
"You promised me that you were going to move down low to Los Alamos,"
she said.
"Now I found out that's all been changed, and the project's staying right here at the federal building? And the order came from your committee. What's the idea?"
Carman pursed his lips and put down the papers he was looking at.
The idea, my dear, is for me to keep the project where I can maintain a watchful eye on it. Obviously, I can't do that if it's been transferred to New Mexico, can I?
Damn it, Bryce. You promised I'd be able to go home.
Carmen looked surprised.
Is that what you want? He asked. Are you dissatisfied with your position? I was under the impression that you wanted to be director of the project.
You know perfectly well what I mean,
she retorted.
It's not my position or my work that I'm dissatisfied with. It's this goddamn city. I despise it. You and I had a deal. I gave you Higgins and Cooper, and you said you'd give me Download and let me take it to Los Alamos.
Yes, well, I'm afraid that's proved somewhat impractical, said Carmen, leaning back in his chair and steepling his fingers. Download is a vital and important project, far too important to regulate to the provinces. I kept my word to make you director of the project, but I'm afraid it will have to remain in New York.
You bastard! I committed perjury for you, and now you're welching on the deal, you double-crossing son of a bitch!
Carmen gave her a hard stare.
Be careful, Jennifer. You're treading on very thin ice.
God damn it, Bryce! You promised me!
She shouted, enraged and frustrated.
If it meant getting Oliver Higgins out of the way, I would have promised you my immortal soul, said Carmen Riley. Though, in some ways, I'm rather sorry to see him gone. He was a stimulating antagonist. However, that's quite beside the point. The point is that you agreed to take the job as chief cybernetics engineer for Project Download. You knew what it entailed. You knew that it meant moving to New York. The fact that New York doesn't appeal to your sensibilities and lifestyle is frankly not my problem, Jennifer. The decision was yours, and you made it. No one twisted your arm. What's more, you've come quite far since then. You hardly have a reason to complain. You saw your opportunity to dislodge Higgins, and you took it. I fulfilled my part of the bargain by having you made director of the project. And I've continued to support you, despite the fact that I've been under considerable pressure to remove you from your current post following your recently televised sexual frolic with Higgins, whom you subsequently stabbed in the back. Some of my colleagues have taken to calling you the Black Widow, he smiled. She mates and then she kills.
She paled and compressed her lips into a tight grimace.
God damn you.
Don't damn me, my dear. That was none of my doing. I can't help it if you were indiscreet enough to get your ashes hauled in a room equipped with a video camera. It was your own inability to control your lust that made you a nationally known porn star.
You cocksucker.
In a smooth motion, Carmen rose from his chair and gave her a stinging slap across the cheek. It was a powerful blow that sounded like a rifle crack. It knocked her to the floor. He came around the desk, bent over her, and grabbed her by the hair, jerking it hard and making her cry out.
Now you listen to me, my dear,
he said in a calm, perfectly controlled voice.
If you behave like a slut, you're going to be treated like one. You understand?
Still holding her by the hair, he slapped her again, then struck her one more the other way, a backhanded blow, drawing blood from her lip. She whimpered with pain and stared up at him in terror and disbelief.
Now, the next time you come bursting into my office, unannounced, and start running off at the mouth like some common prostitute, you're gonna have to crawl out, he said, gazing down at her without emotion.
He hauled her to her knees and stood over her, grasping her painfully by her long red hair. Blood trickled from her lips as she stared up at him with shock and fear.
Without me, Jennifer, you're nothing, he said. I'm all that stands between you and the utter ruin of your career. One word from me, and you'll be reduced to walking the streets like the common tramp you are. You sold yourself to me, and now I own you. You would be wise to remember that.
He released her.
Now get out, and don't show your face again unless I send for you.
She rose to her feet unsteadily and staggered out the door.
Dinner was a potluck thrown together from leftovers, for which Donna Barrett apologized and tried to compensate by serving a very nice red wine, which she herself did not drink.
Steele and Raven both insisted she had nothing to apologize for. She was being more than gracious. She was breaking the law by giving them shelter, and they were the ones who should apologize.
Don't be ridiculous, Donna replied. You had nowhere else to go.
She was a good-looking woman in her late 30s, living alone in a small railroad flat on Perry Street ever since the tragedy that had struck down her children, destroyed her marriage, and plunged her into the black depths of alcoholism. She was recovering now, and though her hands still trembled slightly, she looked clear-eyed and, for the first time in years, felt like a human being. She had crawled out of the bottle and was making a new beginning. She had Donovan Steele to thank for that. She had once been married to an engineer named Jonathan Barrett, and they had three small children, twin boys and a girl. One day, while on a picnic in the park, their children had been attacked by a screamer, a highly contagious and psychotic victim of the dreaded Virus 3, a legacy of the Biro War. Jonathan had panicked and fled. Donna, heedless of her own safety, had driven out the screamer by wielding the picnic basket as a weapon. But by then it was too late. The children had all been infected. They were already manifesting signs of the disease by the time they brought them to the hospital, where absolutely nothing could be done for them. There was no cure for Virus 3. Its victims broke out in hideous suppurating sores within hours or even minutes of being infected, and then became hopelessly insane, attacking anything that moved like rabid dogs until the disease literally rotted them away. The law was clear. The children had to be put to sleep. Donna had had a nervous breakdown for which Jonathan had never forgiven her. She had left him alone to deal with his guilt, with no one to strike out at to assuage the angst. He had embarked upon an affair with Donna's younger sister, and when Donna came out of the hospital, he left her. He died not long afterward, driven to suicide by guilt. Donna had started drinking to numb the pain, and she had kept on drinking until everything else was numb as well. But, unknown to her until only a few days ago, another man was dreaming of her. That man was Steele. Over and over again, he kept having the same nightmare, a nightmare in which he, Steele, was married to her, a nightmare in which he relived the day their children were attacked, though he had never really lived it in the first place. That dream, so similar to an experience in Steele's own past, had tormented him and confused him. When he was a boy, his mother had also succumbed to Virus 3 and had attacked his two younger brothers and his father, infecting them. His father had shot her, then turned the gun on his two younger sons and himself, leaving Steele an orphan. For years thereafter, Steele had suffered from nightmares in which he had relived his family's destruction. He could not understand why he had suddenly started dreaming of the same thing happening to someone else's family, a family of strangers that inexplicably seemed to feel like his own. It was only after the dream had been plaguing him for quite some time, along with other dreams in which he seemed to relive pieces of other people's lives, that he found out the cause of the phenomenon. When his personality had been downloaded from his organic brain into a computer, and his engram matrix was created, it had been supplemented with ancillary engram data, drawn from other test subjects who had participated in the download experiments. Jonathan Barrett had been one of these test subjects. A part of Jonathan Barrett had become a part of Steele. He remembered Donna, even though he'd never met her. He felt connected to her. But he had not known who she was or what the dream meant. He had kept the dreams to himself, not even confiding in his therapist, Dev Cooper, who had suspected that something was troubling Steele, but was at a loss to get him to talk about it. Cooper had expressed his frustration to Dr. Philip Gates, the man who had been the chief cybernetics engineer of the project before Jennifer Stone came in to take his place after his death. Gates had come up with an unorthodox solution. If Cooper suspected that Steele was keeping something back and Steele would not cooperate, they might not go directly to the source, his engram matrix. Without authorization, Gates had pulled a copy of the backup matrix of Steele's personality, stored in the project databanks, and given it to Cooper. He had hooked up audio peripherals with voice synthesizer capabilities, programmed to respond with Steele's voice, and arranged to have Dr. Julie Nakamura show Cooper how to wire an imperative into the program. Thus, Cooper had an electronic clone of Steele in his own personal computer, one programmed to respond under an imperative. The implications had staggered Cooper, especially when the Matrix came online and became self-aware, demanding with Steele's voice to know what had happened to its body. At first, it had thought that it was Steele, and in a sense, it was. It was an exact duplicate of his personality, but when it realized that it was just a backup, an electronic clone, it had rebelled against the programmed imperative and defeated it. And then it had escaped. Somehow it was able to travel through the wires just like electricity, and it was now loose somewhere in the electronic net, capable of going anywhere it wanted. With the deaths of Ice, Higgins, and Dev Cooper, there was only a handful of people who knew of its existence. Carmen and his committee, Jennifer Stone, Steele, Raven, and now Donna Barrett. Steele had finally found her in a bar, drowning in a glass of whiskey, and he had shared the story of his dreams with her, as well as the explanation for them. In a way, they both shared the same tormented past, and together they had found a way to lay that past to rest. The relentless nightmares had been plaguing her as well. Now they were gone. For both of them.
"I told you before," said Donna, "that if you ever needed me for anything, I'd be here. Well, I'm here, and you need me. You both need a place to stay, and you had nowhere else to go. What are we going to do? Huddle in some burned-out building out in no man's land?"
"Yes, if need be," Steele said. "It would have been safer for you. I don't like having you involved. You're breaking the law by harboring a fugitive."
"I don't read the newspapers," Donna said, "and I'm not interested in current events. If the police come knocking on my door, I'll break the TV and say that it's been that way for months. How was I supposed to know they were looking for you? You were an old friend, someone I knew from years ago when you were on the strike force. You happened to need a place to stay, and I put you and Raven up for a few days. How was I to know you were a fugitive? You used to be a cop, for God's sake."
"You've got a very devious mind,"
said Raven with a grin.
"Hey, girl, I'm a survivor," Donna said. "Besides, I'm not the one who's being devious. It's that bastard Carmen and that bitch, Jennifer Stone. And once that interview you did with Linda Tellerman gets aired, they'll get what's coming to them."
"I'm afraid it's not that simple," Steele said. "This interview won't solve all our problems, but at least it's beginning."
He glanced at his watch.
"Which reminds me, it's about time for the evening news."
They switched on Channel 7. The lead story was about the citywide manhunt for Steele. There was someone else sitting in for Linda Tellerman, who was on assignment.
"What the hell?"
said Raven, frowning.
"Where's Linda? And what happened to the interview?"
"I'm afraid I can guess,"
Steele said slowly. He went to the phone. He dialed a certain number.
"Matrix, are you there?"
"I'm here, Steele,"
his electronic alter ego responded.
"I need your help.
I should have that information on Bryce Carmen for you shortly. I'm encountering some interesting false trails regarding some of his financial interests."
"Stay with it, but I need you for something else now. I need to get in touch with Linda Tellerman at Channel 7, and I want to make sure the call isn't traced. Can you run interference for me?"
"I'll take care of it. You want me to listen in?"
"Yes, you might as well, but do it discreetly."
"All right, one moment. I'll get her for you."
A moment later, Steele heard the phone ring.
"Eyewitness News."
"I need to speak with Linda Tellerman immediately," said Steele.
"May I ask who's calling?"
"Donovan Steele."
The person on the other end inhaled sharply. There was a brief silence.
"One moment, please."
Steele turned up his hearing. The sound was muffled, as if someone was holding a hand over the receiver.
"It's him, Steele. He wants to talk to Linda."
"Okay, keep him talking. Stall him. Tell him she's not at her desk. You're having her paged or something."
"One moment, please, Lieutenant Steele. She doesn't seem to be at her desk. I'll have her paged."
"If she's not on the phone in 30 seconds, I'm hanging up," said Steele.
I'm doing my best, sir. We're trying to find her."
"Tell whoever it is you're talking to over there that I know they're trying to trace this call," said Steele. "Get Linda on the phone line right now, or I'm hanging up."
A moment later, she picked up the phone.
"Steele, it's Linda. Listen."
"No, you listen. I know they're trying to trace this call. It won't do them any good. What happened to my interview?"
"It was pulled, Steele. Believe me, it wasn't my decision. I fought it. I refused to go on air unless they ran it. But they called my bluff. They've seized the tape as evidence, and there isn't a thing I can do about it."
"Can you go on the air and say what they've done?" asked Steele.
"I've been told that if I do that, I'll be prosecuted for obstruction of justice and aiding and abetting a fugitive. And management won't back me up. I'm really sorry, Steele."
"Yeah, so am I."
"I wouldn't have believed that they could do this,"
she said.
"Listen, I know it looks bad, but I'm still on your side. If you can give me that proof we talked about..."
"I'll see what I can do," said Steele. "In the meantime, don't rock the boat. I don't want to see you get in any trouble on my account."
"Hey, I'm not about to take this lying down,"
she replied.
"I've got a call into my lawyer. They can't get away with this."
"You'd be surprised what they can get away with," Steele said. "Especially when it's someone like Carmen's pulling the strings. Watch your back, Linda."
"You too,"
she said.
"Be careful, Steele."
He hung up.
"Well, the first round's gone to Carmen," he said grimly. "But the fight's a long way from being over."
Back in the studio, the marshal turned to the technician and anxiously said,
"Well, did you get it?"
The technician frowned and shook his head.
"I don't understand. It doesn't make any sense."
"What? Where'd the call come from?"
"Right here,"
the man replied, bewildered.
"What do you mean, right here? You mean he's right here in this building?"
"No, I mean the call came from right here in this room,"
the man said, puzzled. He glanced around with confusion at the other phones in the newsroom.
"What?"
the marshal said incredulously.
"I can't understand it. We must have got our wires crossed or something, but I can't see how."
The technician shook his head hopelessly.
"It just doesn't make any sense."
"Jesus H. Christ, are you telling me you blew the trace?"
"I'm telling you, we traced it to one of the lines in this room. I can't see how that could have happened."
"God damn it!"
"He told me it wouldn't work,"
said Linda with a smile.
"Looks like you've underestimated him."
"Look, you've already made one big mistake, lady,"
snapped the marshal.
"Don't go making it any worse on yourself."
"I'm not the one making a big mistake,"
she replied.
"You are. You're backing Steel into a corner, and I wouldn't want to be in your shoes when he decides to start fighting back."
"When he does, we'll be more than ready for him,"
said the marshal confidently.
"And then you'll have your story. We'll take that renegade cyborg down once and for all. There won't be nothing left to him but nuts and bolts."
And then gave him a level stare.
"Don't hold your breath,"
she said. Officer Kevin Bishop and his partner, Sergeant Jim Morris, were cruising slowly down West Street, heading south in their armored strike force unit. Bishop was a young man, dark and slightly built, a rookie on the strike force, but his small frame and youthful appearance were deceptive. He was a crack shot and an expert in the martial arts who had passed the rigorous strike force training at the head of his class. His partner, Sergeant Morris, was a stark contrast to him in appearance. Husky and solidly built, with prematurely graying hair, Morris was a combat veteran who joined the department after serving 3 tours in the Army, assigned to hazardous armed escort duty for the convoys that supplied the city from the upstate agro communes. He had seen his share of action.
"If you ask me, this assignment stinks," said Bishop.
"I didn't ask you,"
Morris replied, staring straight ahead as he drove the cruiser.
"Jim, you knew Steel, didn't you?"
"Yeah, I knew him. He was a friend of mine."
"Was?"
"That's right, was."
"Then you actually believe this crap about him going off the deep end?"
Bishop asked.
"Listen, Mick Taylor was a friend of mine too,"
Morris replied.
"I never would have thought that Mick could go bad, but after they turned him into a cyborg, he went nuts and became a homicidal maniac. That wasn't Mick Taylor anymore, and Steel isn't Steel anymore either."
"Yeah, well, I just can't believe it,"
Bishop said, watching the street.
"Steel was my training officer. I knew him both before he became a cyborg and after. He was the sanest man I ever knew either way."
"So was Mick Taylor,"
Morris replied.
"They were both good cops, Kevin, but you can't replace a man's brain with a computer and still expect him to remain the same. It's crazy, and it ain't natural. I sure as hell wouldn't want anyone doing that to me. I wouldn't want to live that way. You couldn't call that living."
"Did you know Higgins?"
Bishop asked.
"Never met the man."
"Well, I did," said Bishop. "And I don't believe what they're saying about him either. They didn't come any straighter than Higgins. That man was a patriot. He cared about this country. A man like that just doesn't do what they say he did."
"Higgins was a spook,"
said Morris.
"You never know what that bunch will do."
"What about Dr. Cooper? He strike you as the sort of man who'd get in a shootout with federal marshals?"
"I never knew Cooper. That's neither here nor there. What are you saying, Kevin? You believe they're lying to us?"
"What do you mean, the government doesn't lie?"
Bishop asked sarcastically.
"Don't be a wise ass. They'd have to have a reason,"
Morris said.
"What reason would they have for wanting Steel out of the way?"
"I've been thinking about that. This whole thing turns on Dr. Stone's testimony. She came forward and testified to this big cover-up at the project, and the next thing you know, she's made the director of it. Doesn't that strike you as a little odd?"
"Maybe, but if she was trying to pull something, then why didn't Higgins and Cooper stand up to her and disprove her charges? Innocent men don't go on the run."
"I don't know,"
said Bishop.
"I know it looks bad, but something about this whole thing just doesn't smell right to me."
"If there's nothing really wrong with Steel, then why doesn't he come in and prove it?"
Morris asked.
Maybe because he knows what would happen if he did, said Bishop.
He killed 5 federal marshals, Morris said.
I read those reports too, Bishop replied. And according to some of the witnesses, those marshals were killed by whoever it was in that cab he ran to.
Maybe. There's conflicting testimony. Either way, those men are dead. And even if Steele didn't kill him himself, that still makes him an accessory.
That's not the point, said Bishop. The point is, Steele ran. He didn't stand and fight. Does that sound like the Donovan Steele you knew?
Morris paused a moment.
No, it doesn't. But that doesn't prove anything. Look, I don't like it any better than you do, but we've got our orders. If you've got problems with that, Kevin, then I think...
Wait a minute. Slow down. On the street corner. There!
A young woman came staggering out from a side street. She was dressed in a black leather miniskirt and boots. Her halter top had been torn away, revealing her naked breasts. She slumped against the side of a building, then slid down to the sidewalk.
Looks like another hooker went and got herself raped,
said Morris, pulling over to the curb.
Want me to call it in?
Asked Bishop.
Nah, don't bother. They're long gone by now. She probably won't even want to file charges, but she could be hurt. We better go and see if she's all right.
They got out of the car and walked over to where the woman was sprawled out on the sidewalk. Bishop crouched down beside her.
Miss, are you all right?
Raven rolled over and pointed a .357 Magnum revolver at his face.
Don't go for your gun, Jim, Steele said. I don't want to shoot you.
Bishop remained crouching where he was, his gaze riveted on the barrel of the gun. Morris started to turn around.
Don't move, Jim. Stay right where you are. You don't want to do this, Steele,
Morris said, keeping his voice level and making no sudden moves.
Yes, I do. I want you to listen to me. But I don't want you getting tempted. Take out your sidearm with 2 fingers, crouch down very slowly, and place it on the sidewalk where I can see it. Then stay in that position.
Morris did as he was told.
You're gonna kill us too, Steele. If you make me shoot you, Jim, I'll only wound you, Steele replied. But you won't like it very much. So let's be sensible, okay? I only want to talk.
Morris placed his Strike Force issue 44 Magnum semi-auto on the sidewalk, then remained where he was, in a crouching position.
Now the 9mm in your ankle holster, Steele said.
Morris took that out and placed it down as well.
And now the one in your shoulder rig.
The third gun was placed on the sidewalk.
And now the knife.
Morris took his combat bowie out of the sheath strapped to his thigh and put it down beside his guns.
Okay, Kevin, you do the same.
Steele said. He waited until Bishop had divested himself of all his weapons.
All right, Steele said. Now both of you stand up slowly, get up against the building wall, and assume the position.
He waited until they were leaning with their palms against the wall, legs spread. Then he pointed to Raven, who gathered up their guns and put them in a canvas bag, still tossed down on the sidewalk. Only then did she pause to adjust her halter top.
Let's get back to the cruiser, fellas,
Steele said.
I want you both to get in the back seat.
Once they were inside, Raven got in behind the wheel, and Steele got into the passenger seat, facing backward, watching the 2 Strike Force cops through the wire mesh.
You gonna add kidnapping police officers to the charges against you, Steele?
Asked Morris.
I'm not kidnapping you, Jim,
Steele replied as Raven pulled away from the curb.
I told you, I just want to talk. Okay, then you've got a captive audience,
said Morris.
Do you think I've gone insane like Stalker Jim?
Steele asked.
Does it really matter what I think?
Asked Morris.
It does to me. Well, in that case, the truth is I don't know. Bishop here seems to have his doubts, but then he didn't know Mick Taylor like I did either. Yeah,
Steele said grimly.
Good point. But what do you think, Jim? What do your instincts tell you? Do I seem crazy to you? I'm not a shrink. Or a cybernetics engineer. If there's nothing wrong with you, and if you didn't kill those marshals, why don't you let us take you in and straighten this whole thing out? I'd like to, Jim. I really would, said Steele. But I think if I let you take me in, I wouldn't last long enough to tell my side of the story. Come on, Steele.
Morris said.
We don't work that way, and you know it.
No, Strike Force doesn't, but the Marshals do,
Steele replied.
You know that so-called shootout at the Enclave where Higgins and Cooper bought it along with a bunch of agency personnel?
What about it?
It never happened. I was there. The moment the Marshals hit the place, Higgins ordered all his people to surrender, and they were all executed.
I saw the firefight on TV,
Morris said.
You saw something that was staged for the TV cameras after the fact,
Steele replied.
Did you actually see who was doing all the shooting? All the footage showed was gunfire coming from the mansion. By that time, Higgins and all the others were already dead. I knew it, Bishop said. I knew something stank about that story.
All right, said Morris. Assuming that's the truth, then why? What reason would they have?
Garmin's behind it all, said Steele. He wanted to take Download away from the agency and disband the CIA. He almost pulled it off last month when he convinced Congress to vote down our budget. But then General Cord attempted his takeover of the government. When we stopped him, Garmin had the rug pulled out from under him. We were all heroes, and he couldn't shut us down. But he's not the type to give up easily. He waited till the right opportunity arose, and he got it when Jennifer Stone went to him with a story about a massive cover-up at the project.
You mean there wasn't anything to that story? Bishop asked.
Oh, there was something to it, all right, said Steele. Dev Cooper took home some classified material so he could work on it. Material having to do with me. Since he had top clearance and was also my therapist, Phil Gates, who was the chief engineer at the time, didn't see any reason why he shouldn't simply give it to him. Only they never bothered putting anything in writing. Higgins found out about it, but he chose not to make an issue out of it.
You mean that's it? Said Bishop incredulously.
That's the cover-up?
Not quite, Steele replied. I was ordered to report into Project Headquarters, but I was following up an investigation of my own at the time, and I had a hot lead. I didn't feel that I could drop it just then.
There was a little more to it than that. He was, in fact, following up an investigation at the time. But it wasn't police business. It was personal. He had been looking for Donna Barrett. He hadn't obeyed orders to come in because he was afraid that he was starting to malfunction. And rather than risking harming anyone at headquarters or risk harm to Raven, he had holed up in the no man's land, waiting to see if any further indications of trouble developed. If they did, he had planned to kill himself before what happened to Stalker could happen to him. What had made him think he was having trouble was receiving a phone call from himself. When he heard his own voice on the line, he had thought that he was losing his mind. But it wasn't his imagination. It had been the Matrix trying to get in touch with him. Steele decided not to complicate things by telling him about the Matrix.
If that's all there was to it, how the hell did it get blown out of proportion?
Morris asked.
You've got Carmen to thank for that, Steele said. And Jennifer Stone. She was involved in a relationship with Higgins. I don't know all the details, but apparently things went sour somehow, and she decided to stick it up to him. She went to Carmen, and he saw an opportunity to take her story about a cover-up and use it to seize Download and shut down the agency. After what happened with Stalker, putting out the story that I'd refused to come in because my brain was malfunctioning made his case that much stronger. The only trouble was, Higgins, Cooper, and I knew the real story. I was still out following up on my investigation, so I didn't know that any of this was going on. Carmen put out the word to have me found and stopped before I could do the same kind of damage Stalker did. Higgins realized that amounted to putting out a contract on me, so he tried to warn me. He had ICE out looking for me as well as all the agents he could spare. He got to my place and got Raven out of there, along with all my gear, before the Marshals could get there. And he left an agent named Sharp stationed there to warn me in case I got called in. Only the Marshals got there first and took Sharp into custody.
Steele continued.
When I came back, I walked right into a trap. I didn't know what the hell was going on. I asked to call Higgins so I could get the whole thing straightened out. Only they told me that there was an order out for his arrest as well. That's when I knew something was seriously wrong. I wasn't even sure that they were really federal marshals at that point. They then brought Sharp down. They'd worked him over pretty good. As he saw me, Sharp told me to run. I managed to break out of there and take him with me. Sharp was hurt, so I picked him up and ran. They started shooting.
I returned their fire, but I was careful not to hit anyone. I made one of their units crash by shooting out the tires, but that's about it.
Then what about those 5 men who were killed?
Asked Morris.
That was Ice, said Steele. Him and a guy named Slim pulled up just as I came running out of the building.
Slim?
Morris said.
Ex-girl about 60-some years old, pimps and drives a gypsy cab.
That's him. He worked with me before.
So they came pulling up, see people shooting at you, and return the fire, Bishop said.
And that's how those marshals bought it?
That's about it,
Steele replied.
After we got away, we drove out to the Enclave. That's where I got the full story. Def Cooper and I were planning to come back and tell our story to the media, but the marshals hit us right about then. Something interesting about that, too. Moments after their choppers came in, we were attacked by some of the locals. Ever since we drove out the Borodinis and took over the Enclaves, the locals had been giving us trouble. Higgins seemed to think that the Borodini was egging them on. It was interesting that they should attack in force at the same time as the marshals hit us. Anyway, I got away with Ice and Raven. We stole one of their choppers, but as we were lifting off, another chopper opened up on us. That's when Ice was killed. I had to shoot it down. I flew back to the city, ditched the chopper down by the Manhattan Bridge, and we've been hiding out ever since. Last night, I contacted Linda Tellerman over at Channel 7, and taped an interview with her for tonight's 6 o'clock news. It was never aired. The marshals had it pulled. And they've threatened her with prosecution if she so much as opens her mouth. She's a tough lady, and she's called her lawyer in, but I don't know how much good that's going to do. Garmin's pulling all the strings. He's already got Higgins and Cooper out of the way. Ice is dead too. That only leaves me. And you guys have orders to shoot me on sight. Correct.
Correct, said Morris. You were right, Kevin. This whole thing stinks.
So then you don't think I'm crazy?
Steele asked.
You don't think I'm crazy to me,
Morris replied.
I've never liked that only best with Carmen. I could see him doing something like this. The question is, what can you do about it?
I've got to get the goods on him somehow, Steele said. But that's going to be hard to do with every cop in the city out gunning for me. I just wanted you guys to know that I'll do everything I can to stay out of your way. I don't want to kill anybody, least of all a cop, but I can't allow myself to be taken in. If Strike Force places me under arrest, the feds will come in and take custody. Carmen can't afford to let me talk. Let me put out of commission.
Does Jake know any about this?
Bishop asked.
Not yet, said Steele. I was hoping maybe you could tell him.
Okay, leave it to us,
said Morris.
I'll get the word out, but that won't help you with the feds.
I know that, but I don't just want to go up against any of my brother officers if I can help it,
Steele replied.
Raven, stop the car.
She pulled over to the curb.
I'm leaving your weapons in this bag on the front seat, said Steele. I'm going to trust you not to come after me, Jim.
They got out of the cruiser, and Steele took the keys from Raven. He unlocked the back doors and let the two cops out. He backed away and then tossed them the keys.
Good luck, Steele,
said Bishop.
Thanks, Kev. I'll need it.
Then they were gone. End of chapter.